Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, turning the clock back on aging. But first, Southern California is still ablaze, and the Thomas Fire has now become the state's fourth biggest fire in recorded history. This week, we also heard that a fire engineer lost his life fighting that fire. The blaze is now a third contained after ripping through more than 200,000 acres and destroying 1,000 buildings and homes. And last week, we talked about the ways climate change can make fires like this one worse, drying out fuels and jacking up the thermostat. But one of my next guests found another factor that overrides even the effects of climate, and that is humans. At least in heavily populated areas, the presence of humans can have a big effect on what burns and when. A factor, she says, should be part of our conversation on how to manage wildfire. Alexandra Seifert is a senior research scientist at the Conservation Biology Institute in Corvallis, Oregon. Alexandra's work appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'd also like to bring on Camille Stevens-Ruman. She is also has a study out this week in Ecology Letters on Climate Change, Fire, and Our Natural Landscapes. She's an assistant professor of forest and rangeland stewardship at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and a former wildlife firefighter. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first, Alexandra, give us a snapshot of what you found here. Humans can override the effects of climate change on wildfire?
That's right, but the situation is very nuanced. In our study, we looked at 37 different regions across the continental United States and tried to understand how variation in climate activity controls variation in annual area burned for the different regions. And we found that climate change may be important for fires in some areas because the relationships are strong, but in other areas, climate was not a significant factor in explaining annual area burned. So we asked, why is that? Why are some areas more controlled by climate than others? And the only factor we found to significantly explain this difference in regions was the presence of humans.
Huh.
And so humans can alter fire patterns in a whole range of ways, but the clear signal is that when there are a lot of humans present, it can scramble the relationships between fire and climate.
Dr. Stevens-Ruman, your study looks at places that are more untouched, less influenced by humans, and you found that climate change really does seem to have an effect after wildfires sweep through those places. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we often hear about wildfires, obviously, when they're happening in the news, but these landscapes take a really long time to recover also, right? And that's not something that we hear a lot about.
Yeah.
But what we looked at was what factors might be influencing tree regeneration success or failures. And we found a pretty interesting relationship with the hotter and drier conditions that we've seen since 2000, and that resulting in a decrease in regeneration density as well as regeneration success at all. So we had about 30% of our sites having no seedlings at all, compared to about 15% if we look at the cooler, drier period that was kind of the end of the 20th century.
Well, why is that? I mean, the fires today different than they used to be, more severe? What's the problem?
Well, we found two main controlling factors. One is distance to a living tree. So this is right those areas that are supplying the actual seeds for recovery. So the farther you are from those, the less likely you are to have regeneration success. And the other one is the average climate on a site. So in those hotter and drier sites that are already kind of at the edge of like the climatic tolerance, those areas are less likely to have tree seedlings than some cooler, moister sites that are perhaps buffered to this climate warming.
Dr. Seifert, what about the chaparral ecosystems in Southern California? Do you think we might see these shrubby ecosystems replaced just like forests are disappearing in the Rockies?
That's indeed one of the biggest concerns we have ecologically, is that the native chaparral shrubland vegetation is on a trend of declining and being replaced by weedy exotic grasses that are highly flammable, and you can actually create what's called a fire cycle or fire grass cycle, in which the fire, too much fire, is detrimental to the shrublands, and it's replaced by flammable grasses that are even more flammable, and thus facilitating this feedback. So the drought conditions may also interact with fire, like they did in the other study, in that it can potentially inhibit recovery of chaparral species after a fire.
Oh, so the drought, does that circle back to a warmer climate and climate trends here?
In terms of, well, it could. We don't know that for sure, but we have seen an anomalously long drought from 2012 to 2015 in California. And as a result of that drought, there's been substantial tree mortality in the state, and we may be seeing some signs of inhibited recovery of species as well, inhibited regeneration.
Let me ask both of you, does that mean your research show that we may have to think more about where we let people do their thing and build their homes in terms of forests?
I think the urban interface is always a concern, both from a firefighting perspective, but also an ecological perspective. But I feel like our study really shows two main things. And one is that we need to be better at managing our lands, doing more things like prescribed fire and fuel treatments, and allowing fires to burn under less extreme conditions. And that can help break up that fuel pattern, those continuous fuels that allow fires to burn under really extreme conditions. And then think about how we manage those landscapes after a fire as well.
Mm-hmm. Where do most firefighter fatalities happen?
In general, we see those predominantly in that urban interface, largely because we tend to value somebody's home over saving just one more tree. And so we're willing to put ourselves at greater risk to save those human values.
Mm-hmm. And Alexandra, do you think people can adapt to having more frequent, more intense fires?
Well, that is the difficult question, because getting back to your previous question about the effect of development, one of my favorite quotes came from Roger Kennedy from the National Park Service, who said, the problem isn't fires, the problem is people in the wrong places. And what we have right now are anomalously large impacts of fire. And a lot of that is because we're building increasingly more homes within flammable wildland areas. So I think it's important to start factoring this into our conversations about policy and thinking about ways that we could potentially manage development patterns or, in some cases, prevent ignitions, which are ultimately the start of all the fires.
So this becomes a political issue then?
It does become a political issue.
Somebody's laughing.
Yeah, sorry, that was Camille. I would just add that I don't think we are aware that this is an issue, and I feel like a lot of our management agencies know that we need to be doing management, and obviously they're doing, my work and many other fire science research is funded by the government.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of overcoming those monetary and personnel hurdles to both communicating that science and having better informed communities and better prepared communities, but also instituting those management actions.
Well, you know, speaking of management, you know, how similar is this to flooding, you know, and sea level rise, where you have insurance companies who are saying, we're not going to insure you to rebuild right where it's going to flood again? Is there a similarity with firefighting and fires starting here?
I have actually, ironically, when the Thomas Fire broke out last week, I was in a workshop with 11 other scientists, social scientists, and ecologists discussing this very question of post-fire rebuilding and incentives or disincentives for putting developments into places analogous to the whole floodplain concept.
Yeah.
And it's, I think there are a few challenges, and I think that there's a lot of information we still need to collect, because we can't start telling people where to place their homes unless we really know for sure the best places to put them. And there's a lot of research on that. Some of the maps are too broadly based, and they don't do a very good job at really distinguishing those areas where homes may be more at risk than other areas. So there's a lot of work yet to be done, but there are also some really obvious places. If you put your house on a ridge in a wildland area, you've automatically increased the probability that if your home has a fire near it, it will be exposed to that fire.
Yeah. Do you think people then should be thinking more about this? This is going to be a big, big political issue, do you think?
One other thing I would like to mention, and one of the main messages from this study that just came out, is that it's important to understand that a one-size-fits-all management strategy is not appropriate, because there's so much geographical variation in all of these different factors that not only control fire activity, but also control the impacts of fires to ecological and human systems. And so I think that this needs to also be part of the discussion in terms of both management and policy, and knowing where and when to apply the appropriate strategies.
All right. Well, we've started that discussion. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Alexandra Seifert, Senior Research Scientist at Conservation Biology Institute in Corvallis, Oregon. And Camille Stevens-Ruman is an Assistant Professor of Forest and Rangeland Stewardship at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and a former wildland firefighter. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, new studies out now from the young field of aging research. We'll talk with some experts about the new thoughts about how to grow old and the best way to do that. Stay with us.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and now we turn to look at what's new in the hot young field of aging research. People, you know, they've been searching for something as mythical as agelessness since Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth. You remember him. And it's a topic that philosophers and writers and researchers have been thinking about for a lot longer. Thankfully, scientists these days are after something a lot more attainable than immortality. The goal now is simply to live healthier, longer, and new advances are being made rapidly, many of them by my two guests. One of them, a pioneer in the field of molecular biology and aging. The second, an expert in the role diet and exercise play in aging. Let me introduce them now to you. Cynthia Kenyon, Vice President of Aging Research at Calico, one of Google's Alphabet companies, and she's Emeritus Professor from the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Kenyon, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Eric Verdin is president and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. Dr. Verdin, welcome to Science Friday.
Delighted to be here.
So I talk about, you know, this is the new age of it's young, but we seems like we've been studying aging for a while. What is new about studying aging now, Cynthia?
Well, basically for years and years, like you said at the very beginning, people wanted something like a fountain of youth, but really most people really believed that there was just nothing you could do about aging. It was just something that happens.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is. And in the last 20 years or so, there's really been a complete shift, a paradigm shift in our thinking. And the reason for that is we now know that you can take animals in the laboratory and you can perturb them. You can change their genes or do other things, kind of interventions for them. And you can slow down the rate of aging and extend their lifespan by a lot. Like you can double it or even more than that in some cases. So the animals look normal. It's just that they're aging more slowly. So I think that has really made people think, oh my gosh, first of all, if it can happen for animals, what about people? And second, how would we do that? And would we stay healthy, you know? Because as you said, we really want, the prime goal is to have a very healthy life in old age.
So, Dr. Verdin, we don't have to accept this idea that we naturally have to grow old, lose our abilities, our muscles, our mental capacities. There is something we can do about that.
No, and this is what this amazing field has actually been showing, that in some of the interventions that we can have in animal models, they not only live longer, but their lifespan and their health span, which we define as the healthy years of life, actually increase. So these animals not only live longer, but they are suffering less from what we typically associate as the chronic disease of aging.
Hmm. So let's talk about then the main pathways of aging that are most popular right now in aging research. Eric, tell us about those.
So the key pathways, one of the oldest experiments that was conducted looking at aging was looking at calorie restriction. This is the idea of decrease the calorie intake that an animal will have. And this is in many animal species associated with an increase in lifespan. And so that has early pointed a very bright light on metabolism and diet and nutrition as one of the key variables that controls lifespan. And this is is now being explored actually in humans with some novel medicines that have been used in the past that are thought to be doing the same thing in humans.
And Dr. Kenya, which of these pathways does your work fall under?
Well, we found what we did in our laboratory was we just asked a simple question, you know, are there genes for aging? Can you change genes and slow down aging? And there were hints that you could, and we found that there's one particular gene, and when we changed it, we sort of damaged it, basically. What we found was that we doubled the lifespan and slowed down aging. Now, when we and others studied those genes to find out how on earth they did that, what we found was really, really interesting. We found that they're part of a network that the body has, the animals and people too, that is a sort of surveillance network. It keeps an eye on the environment. And if there are signs of dangerous conditions, for example, food limitation, like Eric just mentioned, or various kinds of stress, this network creates a kind of a shift in the physiology of the body from sort of a happy-go-lucky state to a state in which the body is trying to protect itself. And so what happens is a lot of genes get switched on, and they encode all sorts of protective processes. They encode proteins that help damage proteins be turned over faster, that strengthen the immune system, that block damage from free radicals and oxidative damage. So they do all sorts of different things all together to protect the body. So it turns out that activating this network does allow the animal to survive food limitation and all these other things. But in addition, it seems to protect the body from aging itself, from the damage that's part of aging. So if you switch this on, which we did in the laboratory, then an animal will live longer, and it will have a slower rate of aging. And as Eric says, it's also resistant to many different diseases.
Would you call this an aging gene then? Is it possible?
Yes. I mean, you could call it an aging. It's a gene that controls aging. It also controls, like I said, it controls the animal's, or maybe the person's too, ability to respond to everyday stresses in the environment. So it's not only for aging. But the thing that's really cool is that certain species in nature live longer than others. Like, for example, there are bats that can live to be about 40 years old. And when you look at their genes, what you find is that it looks like this protective system is just on all the time. So it's not just that it comes on sometimes, it's always on. And that's probably why these animals can live so long.
Is it possible to test this out in people, to see this gene, if it works?
Yes, I think it is possible. There is, in fact, it's interesting. So there is a drug called rapamycin that is approved by the FDA, and it's given to people who have had organ transplants. It prevents the body from rejecting the organ transplant. Now, and it's you can take it for years and years. There are side effects, so I don't recommend taking it, and scientists want to make a better version without the side effects. But basically, what this does is it activates this protective response. And if you give rapamycin to animals, all different kinds of animals, little worms, fruit flies, mice, they live longer, and they seem to be aging more slowly, and they get less cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I don't know that it would really slow down aging in people. No one does. But it's possible. And actually, there are scientists at the University of Washington now who are trying to start doing studies with pet dogs to give, sign up dog owners and give the dogs very low doses of rapamycin to see whether it can make them healthier. And they've done a little trial, a little pilot study, and there are, let's just say, glimmers of hope. They need more animals to be sure, but it looks, it's certainly nothing bad, and so far, maybe some things that are good about it. So this is just one little area. There's a whole lot of areas, but this is just one little area that people are excited about.
And Eric, let's talk about things that we can control, like diet and exercise and aging. Can we actually affect our health and age better that way?
Absolutely. One of my favorite quotes in the field is from Jack LaLanne, who said, "Nutrition is queen, exercise is king. Put them together, and you have a kingdom." And today, this is forms the basis of what I think constitutes healthy aging. And a very active field of investigation is, for example, the idea of identifying what is it about nutrition, for example, that actually makes us live longer. And so I talked about calorie restriction early. The field now is looking for what we call calorie restriction mimetics. And these would be drugs, small molecules that would actually mimic the effect of calorie restriction. And Cynthia just talked about rapamycin. This is one example. Another example that is actually quite prominent right now is metformin. So metformin is a drug that is being used for diabetes. It's actually called glucophage. It's one of the most prescribed drug for diabetes. It turns out that diabetics who are on glucophage live longer than non-diabetics. And this is a study that was done a number of years ago, suggesting that metformin might have a anti-aging effect. And so this has triggered a lot of interest from one of our colleagues, actually near Barzilai at Albert Einstein, to ask the question, what would happen if we were to put non-diabetics or people without any disease on metformin and follow them for a number of years, would we prevent the development of the chronic disease of aging? And this is not done in a vacuum, because a lot of work in mice and other model system has shown that metformin prevents cancer and increases lifespan and is generally protective. So that's probably one of the key things about the field of aging today, is the idea that we're right at the cusp of entering the clinic with humans and starting to test the work that's been done at the Buck and other places during the last 20 years, building our understanding of the aging process and really starting to translate it into the clinic. So we could not be more excited about this inflection point.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. Listeners are here. San Jose, Steve, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes. Hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call. I love the program.
Thank you.
I'm 77. 35 years ago, I established a fitness routine involving aerobic training and strength training. I eat and drink everything I want, and that is my secret. I wonder what the science shows about that.
Okay, thanks for calling. You know, there is new research, Eric and Cynthia, that shows that people, you don't have to put up with muscle wasting and things like we always thought you had to, that lifting weights and exercise is very important as you age.
There's a very large body of work that really indicates that exercise is one of the most beneficial activities that you can undertake if you want to live longer. What is much less clear is how actually this happens. And so there's a lot of focus right now that you probably have seen in the popular press reflecting all the work that's going on at this point, trying to understand what is it about exercise and what form of exercise actually are beneficial. Is it endurance or is it 10,000 step on your Fitbit or is it actually high intensity interval training? And these types of questions is where the field is moving now, trying to really address these key questions and providing, you know, the general public and everyone with the information that would lead to the most beneficial way of exercising.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have another question. Let's go to Patrick in Sacramento. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thank you. Hey, I have a question. If organisms have the ability to upregulate these stress-resistance anti-aging genes, why do they not do so at all times? That must imply that there's a real metabolic or other cost that we don't yet recognize.
Good question. Cynthia, have you got an answer for that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, of course, we don't know. These are the kinds of questions that we'll never know the answers to. But one possibility that makes a lot of sense is that it takes more energy, in a way, more resources to elaborate a body that can protect itself from anything. It's like if you build a house, you can build a little shack or you can build a one with, you know, giant concrete walls, and it's going to take a lot more, it's going to be a lot harder to build the sturdier one. But if there's never any wind and it's a very mild climate, the shack might be just fine. On the other hand, if there are hurricanes, you really want you want that strength from the protected, fortified structure. And so I think that could be the answer. In fact, that's why I think animals bring out this protective ability when they need it, so that they don't have to spend all their food on that.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about aging. Cynthia, what would an anti-aging drug look like? How would it be used? Who would it be for?
Well, that's a terrific question. The world we live in right now, if you wanted to get a drug that you think will slow down aging approved, since, at least in animals, most of the interventions that we can perform also postpone the diseases of aging. So there's something, let me just back up here, there's something about aging that makes you very susceptible to all sorts of diseases, cardiovascular disease, cancer, cognitive disease, diabetes. And the conditions that slow down aging seem to postpone the onset of the diseases, and when they do come, they seem to be milder. So what a person could do is to get a drug approved for a disease. If you have a drug that you think will slow down aging and it also has an effect on cancer, you should be able to get it approved for cancer as long as it's not. And the good thing about that is if it's beneficial for cancer, that's terrific. And also that process involves looking for side effects, you know. So it's a safety process, I think. So anyway, once you get the drug approved for something like that, then it's out there. And then, you know, for example, in the case of metformin, as Eric said, it was originally prescribed for diabetes. And then people started to realize that the diabetics who were taking metformin were not getting cancer and they weren't getting heart disease. So that's the kind of thing that makes you wonder whether a drug that you might already be taking, in this case, you know, might be affecting aging.
Well, people who are listening to this, they're going to say, we're going to get the emails, you're going to get them, where do I get this metformin stuff? How do I get that, my hands on it? What do you say to them?
I think it. You should try to convince your physician that you are eligible for it. It turns out that, to be honest, quite a few people in the aging field actually are on metformin because they've decided not to wait for the result of the experiment. Generally, metformin is a very safe medicine. It's been given to millions of people, and I think this is a very personal decision. It is not approved, you know, in its current indication as an anti-aging medicine. And I think there's, with any medicine, this is a word of caution. There are side effects, and I think it's a personal decision. But if you are in a state where you would be called pre-diabetic, there are certainly many arguments why you should consider asking your physician to prescribe it for you.
All right,
this is something to discuss with him or her.
Is the old phrase, ask your doctor. Yeah,
exactly.
And we should say one more thing about this.
Well, very quickly. Very quickly, quick. You want to say one more?
If you give metformin to a mouse, it doesn't make the mouse immortal. In fact, in some experiments, just because I don't want people to get too excited, it has had no effect on lifespan. And sometimes it has a small effect, like a 6 to 10% effect. So it's not this.
It's not the
huge
fountain of youth. Cynthia Kenyon,
no.
Vice President of Aging Research in the Calico at Calico. Eric Verdin, President and CEO of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to make your Christmas party more exciting using the prisoner's dilemma and something called the ham sandwich theorem. Math for the holidays. It's not hair hurting. It's going to be great. You'll love it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. When you think of the holidays, there are certain things that mark the season. There's a Christmas tree dripping with tinsel and ornaments, the smell of holiday cookies wafting from the kitchen, or maybe it's coming up with a complex formula to figure out the best way to wrap your presents. No? Wait. That last one's not on your list? Well, maybe my next guest I'll help you put it on your list. She says it should be. She's going to tell us how math can make our holidays merrier and how to seeing every day from a more mathematical angle adds more merriment to your holidays. Hannah Fry is a mathematician at the University College London and an author of the book The Indisputable Existence of Santa Claus, subtitled The Mathematics of Christmas. Do you have a holiday-related question you think might be solved with math? Give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Hannah Fry, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me. I mean, there is nothing more magical than a formula. I think we can all agree on that, surely.
Absolutely. And you've taken it to the extreme to applying it to all. you've studied the growth of cities and cattle and tuberculosis, and now you've taken your math and you've applied it to Christmas.
Yeah, I'm almost trying to prove a point that it does apply to anything. That's somewhere deep down. I think that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, so you see math everywhere, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, or maths, as we might call it across the pond there.
Indeed, and I'll try and keep the S off whenever I refer to it in this conversation.
How did you get interested in maths?
I think I always have been, but I think I started off just liking puzzles and liking the challenge of not knowing exactly where something was going to turn and then having a moment where it all clicks into place, that sort of aha moment. And I think that really I got into maths in as though it was a sort of playground, the puzzles and games that you find when you're a kid. But then actually when I was about 12 years old, during one summer holiday, my mum gave me a maths textbook and she made me do one page from it every day during the entire summer holidays. And I had a fun childhood, as you can clearly tell.
Yeah.
But by the time I got back to school, I was I understood everything a lot better. And I think that was the moment where there was a switch and I realised that the puzzles that I'd already enjoyed, you could enjoy, you know, the math that you do at school in the same way.
Yeah. You know, it's the old Richard Feynman idea that you see the world more beautiful because you understand how it works by studying
science. I totally agree.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the great tips you have in your book. You have a way to figure out the exact length of garland or lights you need to decorate your tree.
I certainly do. I mean, anyone who decorates a tree by eye is an amateur, frankly. I think you're gonna need to get out your measuring tape. You're gonna need to get out your protractor. You need to do this properly. Now, unfortunately, the simple version of the formula requires that you have a perfectly cylindrical tree, which is, although mathematically beautiful. I mean, it's physically difficult, shall we say,
to find
a perfectly cylindrical tree. But there is another formula that you can use, which imagines as though the garland wrapping around your tree forms the shape of an Archimedes spiral. So if you know how many loops you want your garland to take, then we've worked out a formula for exactly how long that garland needs to be.
And we have an excerpt.
This is very important stuff.
Yes,
it's very useful and important.
As my math teacher used to say, it's an elegant solution. We have an excerpt on our website that shows the equations for wrapping a tree, and it's on our website at sciencefriday.com/Santa. Of course, so mathematicians and scientists, they use the perfect situation, but we know there's no such thing as in real life as the perfect situation. Let's talk about the main event, the presents. Gifts.
Yeah,
some people
absolutely.
Say you can save paper by wrapping on the diagonal. Is that true?
Well, no, it's not actually. It's a little bit of a myth. You can do some nice things if you wrap presents on the diagonal, especially if you've got a present that's square. You can make all of the corners meet perfectly in the middle of that square and only have to use one piece of tape. That's kind of nice. But the idea that sort of wrapping diagonally is more efficient, actually, when you work out the maths, it's not the case. You may as well just wrap it in the normal method of keeping the edges of the box parallel with the edges of the paper.
Huh. Now, I can wrap a gift that is it a rectangle? If it's a square, it's pretty easy for me to do that. But what about those odd-shaped things, there's any strategies for tackling that?
Well, I mean, there are some shapes that are just, mathematically always going to be more difficult to wrap. And there's a reason for that. It comes down to something which is called the Gaussian curvature. The Gaussian curvature basically measures how curvy something is on its surface. And it's composed of two different numbers. And if you can imagine if you were standing on the equator of the Earth, you would be measuring how curvy the Earth was north to south and how curvy the Earth was east to west. And if it's curving away from you, it's positive. And if it's completely flat, it's zero. Now, the real trick to understanding why some presents are more difficult to wrap than others is knowing that you multiply those two numbers together to get the total Gaussian curvature. But the Gaussian curvature of a surface doesn't change no matter how much you warp it or distort it. And this is the reason why when you eat pizza, you kind of fold it to get it into your mouth.
We do that
so
in New York here.
Straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, right? The reason why that works, the reason why the pizza doesn't flop downwards when you do that, is because of this rule about Gaussian curvature. If you bend it one way, it's going to have a positive curvature in that direction. But when the pizza is flat, it's got zero curvature, right? So it has to have zero curvature at all times, no matter what you do to it. So if you fold it in one way to make it positive, the other direction has to have zero curvature, otherwise it kind of breaks maths. So that's why when you fold it and pick it up, that edge will remain straight, just because those are the rules that Gauss found. Now, the same is true of wrapping paper. Wrapping paper is flat, so it's got zero Gaussian curvature. So you can wrap it around anything that has zero Gaussian curvature very easily. So cylinders are fine, curvy in one direction, not curvy in the other. Flat boxes are fine, zero curvature. But spheres, if you're trying to wrap, say, a soccer ball, you're going to have real trouble because that curves in two different directions, and so it has positive Gaussian curvature. So no matter how well you try and wrap it, you are always going to end up with wrinkles in your wrapping paper. It's just a sort of fundamental fact of wrapping up.
Wow. You know, I never thought you could link wrapping paper and pizza together.
Maths can do that.
Elegant. Now, let's talk about buying presents. We know that buying presents can get a little daunting, and there can be tons of extended families and cousins of cousins. You say that you can use a bit of game theory to figure out what to do. Explain that, please.
Yeah, I mean, this one's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I've got to be honest. It's sort of, it looks at present buying as though you're trying to get the most out of it. So as though you are, I mean, essentially, there's going to be some benefit to someone giving you a gift, right? You're going to get some joy out of that. And you'll probably get a bit of joy in giving someone a gift too. But then there's the sort of cost of the money that you have to spend on that gift and the time and effort that you have to spend on that gift. So if you decide to look at your holiday season as trying to maximize the total amount of joy of receiving, joy of giving, and lack of joy of spending, then you can frame it as this very old and famous problem in game theory, which is called the prisoner's dilemma, which is it essentially pits you against the person, the relative that you're buying a gift for, and tries to decide what is your best strategy to sort of maximize your return, if you like, on that the present swap. Now, if you're just going to give them a present one year in a row, actually, the best thing really is to not buy them a gift at all and just hope that they'll get you one anyway. And then, you know, hooray. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yes, go ahead.
If you're related to them, the chances are you're probably going to meet them for several Christmases in a row. Mm. So you don't want to do that, because then next year, you know, you're not going to get a present. It's going to be just, it's awkward. So instead, what you can do is you can use something called tit for tat, which is a strategy that has been shown to really work in these kind of in these prisoner's dilemmas that end up repeating themselves over a number of iterations over a period of time. So essentially, what you should do, both the most sensible and decent thing, is in the very first year, you should buy someone the best present that you can afford to give them. And then every year after that, you should match the value of the gift that they gave you last year.
That makes sense.
I think people kind of do that anyway, don't they?
Yeah. This is Science Writer from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking with Dr. Hannah Fry, who is co-author of this wonderful little book, The Indisputable Existence of Santa Claus, The Mathematics of Christmas. Co-author is Dr. Thomas Oleron Evans. Did I get that correctly?
Beautifully pronounced.
And we have people who are going to talk about this. Let me go to the phone to David in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, David.
Hi, I'm a math professor at a community college, and I just love this. I actually have applied a little math this season as well. I did the whole Archimedean spiral to figure out how many feet of Christmas lights I needed. And we do a big gift exchange, and so I wrote a program to automatically draw all the names to figure this out so we wouldn't have to spend time doing it. Plus, we couldn't do it because some people live across the country. So those are two ways I use math. Ah,
that's great. Yeah, some.
That is a man who's got Christmas sorted. Properly in the festive spirit.
And I know that math has lots of precise, well-thought-out theorems, but there are two that could be used when thinking about dessert. I love this in the book. I had to cut everything evenly. The ham sandwich theorem and Austin's moving knife procedure. Are these real names?
They're really real, I know. There are some actually just strangely named mathematical theorems. There's the ham sandwich theorem, this one. And there's another one called the sofa moving problem. There's one third one, actually, which I'm just going to back out of. I don't think I can quite say it on radio.
Oh.
But it's a real... All of these are real theorems.
You mathematicians have too much time on your hands.
I know. Especially in the lunchroom, right? So the ham sandwich theorem, which I imagine was devised in a lunchroom, is where you have a ham sandwich, so two slices of bread, one slice of ham. And the question is, using a single cut with your knife, how do you divide that sandwich in exactly two pieces? So not just roughly in two, the top slice of bread has to be exactly in two, the slice of ham has to be exactly in two, and the bottom slice of bread has to be exactly in two. And this bread and ham can be really higgledy-piggledy. It can be kind of all over the place. It doesn't have to be uniform in any direction. And the question is, how do you do that? And ham sandwich theory basically proves that as long as you've got three different items in three-dimensional space, it is always possible to make a single knife cut to directly cut them in half, every single element.
See, I would just fold it in half. That's why I'm not a man.
Or just make someone buy their own sandwich rather than share it.
That's why you're the expert and I'm sitting here talking about the indisputable existence of Santa Claus with Dr. Hannah Fry. Let's go to the phones. We have Ryan in Sacramento, California. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Hi.
Hi,
Ira. I was wanting to ask you, I'm also Jewish, and I wanted to ask about the best way to beat my sister in playing dreidel this Hanukkah.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll ask the expert. Did you? That's not in your book.
I don't know the rules. I don't know the rules of dreidel. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I'd have to look into it.
Yes,
that's my next project.
You'll come back next year and we'll talk about it. Let's talk about Monopoly. One game that you do talk about is how you always win in Monopoly.
Yeah.
No one beats you. Yes. Tell us the secret.
This is a big tradition in my household. Every year we get the Monopoly board out, end up having a massive row. And I think if that's going to happen, it's important that you emerge the victor. You know, I think that's an essential thing. And the key to winning at Monopoly is noticing that not all of the squares are created equally, right? So some squares, some properties in Monopoly are landed on much more than others. And if you know that, that's really the kind of key to getting victory. So actually, the most landed on square is jail. I guess that's kind of unsurprising. 6.27% of rolls of the dice will end up in jail. The most landed on square that you can buy is Illinois Avenue, which actually came as a bit of a surprise to me when I ran the analysis.
Yeah.
And the least landed on one of all, at only 2%, is Park Place, which is one of the big reasons why the navy blue set is... you know, not worth going for. So anyway, if you run this through using those probabilities and add in the amount of money that you can stand to earn and all of the different elements and components of Monopoly, there are essentially two key tips that you can take away. And the first is that actually the best set to go for, the best set of properties to go for, depends on how many opponents you have.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are only playing Monopoly against one opponent, the best sets to go for are either light blue or orange. If you've got two opponents, it's orange and red. And if you've got three or more, you want to go for the green set to be sure that you win. But never go for Park Place or Boardwalk. There's no point. No one lands on them, so there's no point.
Wow. How about building houses? How many houses?
Well, so this is the second tip. Now, actually, it turns out that your return on your investment peaks at three houses.
Oh.
So the best strategy is if you're trying to like work out whether to spend money or not spend money, try and get to three houses on as many properties as you can. And after that, don't bother buying hotels. And there's another reason why this works. Not only does it help with your return on the investment, there's also, it's a bit sneaky, but there's only a limited number of houses in the game. So if you've got three on every one of your properties, you can block other players from buying houses.
That's where the word Monopoly comes from. That chapter on Monopoly is worth the price of the book itself. Let me tell you, I've read it. The book is The Indisputable Existence of Santa Claus, a wonderful book, The Mathematics of Christmas by Dr. Hannah Fry and Dr. Thomas Olerun Evans. It's a great little pickup gift for the last minute for the holiday season. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Fry is a mathematician at the University College of London and, as I say, the author of The Indisputable Existence of Santa Claus. And you can read an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/Santa. Merry Christmas to you, Dr. Fry.
And to you.
And a Happy New Year. That's about all for today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And if you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast so you can listen all week long if you can't hear us live on Fridays. And also say hi to us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And you can hear us anytime on Amazon Echo or Google Home. So every day now is Science Friday. Have a great and safe weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.